Hi, I'm Kevin Clark. I'm Senior Editor and Chief Correspondent for America Magazine. Welcome to AmericaMagazine.org. Today I'm sitting at 30 Rockefeller Center with Ann Curry, the national and international correspondent for NBC News. And Ann is with us today to talk a little bit about faith in the media and current developments in the Catholic Church. Ann recently returned from a trip to Spokane where you met with Archbishop
Supich.
Supich.
He's actually a bishop still. He will become an archbishop when he goes.
Oh, I promoted him, didn't I?
But he will be. He has been promoted by Pope Francis, so you're in good company.
Okay.
He's going to be promoted in Chicago when he's...
November 18th, I believe.
That's right.
And that's when he's going to be installed as the Archbishop of Chicago, which was a big deal for America Magazine. Archbishop Supich is, or Bishop Supich, excuse me, is a friend of the house. And how did you find him? Is he excited? Is he nervous? Is he looking forward to his new role?
I think all of those things are true. I think he is also still very much surprised that he was handpicked by Pope Francis. He's never met Pope Francis. He said Pope Francis couldn't pick me out of a criminal lineup. He's got a sense of humor, obviously. He said that, however... he thinks that it's not his, the choice of him was not sort of meant by the Pope as a message so much as it just reveals the kind of pick that Pope Francis wants to make. That Pope Francis essentially is looking for a pastoral priest who will help essentially people and fulfill the needs of people.
He seemed to be trying to downplay a lot of the analysis that followed his appointment.
Yeah, but I think also that analysis, which is understandable, I mean, it creates a tremendous amount of pressure, and maybe there's too much being read into some of it. But I think that on the whole, the idea of that analysis is right. That in fact, he is, I think, Blaise Supich. The Bishop of Spokane, in the small diocese of Spokane, being named to the as Archbishop of Chicago, the first in about a century to be named even before he becomes an archbishop, a man who is very different in the way he thinks about his role than his predecessor, who is actually not a combative conservative like many archbishops in America, but rather is a sort of moderate, a man who talks about conciliation, and also who does stuff like the Pope. He doesn't live in the bishop's mansion. He doesn't, need a chauffeur. He drives a 2010 Toyota Camry. He even cooks for his fellow priests. He likes to cook pasta and beef bourguignon, and he thinks he loves to make polenta. I mean, there's a kind of
normalcy.
Rootedness.
Yeah.
Right. Normalcy, I think, is a very good word.
And he's planning to live in the rectory in Chicago, not at the Archbishop's mansion there.
That's correct. So, yeah. And yet when you ask him, and as I did, about this level of humility, he again tries to downplay it and says, this is very dangerous territory because, clearly I am a human being who can be prideful. We all can be prideful. I think anybody who's had to tussle with me, he says, would probably not necessarily say that I'm always humble. So I think even about whether he's humble, he's humble.
Well, we like to say at America Magazine that we're the best at humility.
It's just, I think that we are all human beings who are vulnerable to being prideful. And I think that what America Magazine talks about and the people who are involved in it seek, I think, more openly than maybe the rest of us, more deliberately than maybe the rest of us, is what I think we've learned growing up Catholic, many of us, that we should aspire to be. And that is actually to be humble, to be real, to be generous, to think about the other, to realize our great power in helping others suffer less, to do what we can do, which is what we should do, one-on-one. And if we have the power, as now the soon-to-be Archbishop of Chicago, Supich, will have, to, in a more broad way, for lots of people, try to ease their suffering.
Now, you mentioned growing up Catholic. Now, you grew up Catholic in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon.
I was. I lived in Oregon. I have to amend that a little bit. It's a little complicated. My father was a career military man, so I grew up all over the world, actually. We ended up in my high school years in Oregon. My mother is a war bride from Japan. My father was an occupation soldier, which is how they met. And my mother grew up Buddhist from a long line of Buddhist priests and monks and Shinto priests, because that's how they that's how it works in Japan. And she was walking down the street with five children.
Sounds very Catholic. So
I know.
That's
all
good,
right.
You know.
And I was the oldest. And a nun saw us walking down the street and followed us home. And my mother was converted to Catholicism. And we all began our journey into Catholicism when I think I was probably maybe in third grade. That's
really
probably how it all began for me.
So what do you think attracted your mother to the church? I mean, growing up Buddhist, I mean, obviously it was probably difficult for her to find a Buddhist temple, first of all, to continue her faith journey.
Exactly right. There was a great loneliness being an immigrant in America, especially an immigrant who was on the opposite side of such a major war. There was also, I think, the sense, and we have to acknowledge this, in the Catholic Church, when you are in it and experience there is a kind of just immense beauty in the procedures, what happens, what the priests do, and the formalities, and I at that time, was very moved by the incense.
Was reminiscent of the Buddhist for your
all
mother.
Of that. So yeah. I think my mother felt something akin. My mother didn't speak English very well and really struggled. I remember growing up every Sunday going to church and adjusting her, the lace. As a kid, I used to call them doilies on top of our heads. Obviously,
that is the official name for them.
But I know that doilies, the word doily also means something else. And so I didn't run it. I didn't want to diminish
the name.
It.
I'm old enough to vaguely remember the lace. It's a very simple Latin term, and I can't remember it now.
Yeah, well, we'll come to us probably
in
the middle
we'll
of this.
We'll check
all
it on Wikipedia
sudden.
After this.
And I have to tell her when to stand and sit and kneel. And at that time, the Mass was more commonly conducted in Latin, and she had no idea what was being said, but she felt it.
Yeah.
She felt it. And I think that's really ultimately what all that stuff, the incense, the Latin, all that stuff was really meant for us to do. Yeah. It's all meant for us to feel it. And so I essentially was raised Catholic by a Buddhist, which we could talk for hours about that.
Yeah, that sounds very complicated. You had to do a lot of the translating for your mother. Mm. Did you translate scripture for her? I mean, how did that...
I wouldn't say that it was word for word because it was difficult for her, but I would talk about what we were saying in this prayer.
Uh-huh.
So it was being a teacher as a child to my mother about what we were supposed to do in the Catholic Church. I think it helps you kind of understand a little bit, maybe more deeply than maybe you might have otherwise as a child.
Yeah.
In what is being
but
said.
But you've described yourself as a fallen Catholic.
I am at
this point.
And I am going to be honest about it. There has been much that has happened in the Church that's made, I think, it difficult for many Catholics. And I think that I struggle now. I struggle. Mm-hmm. There are times when I'm clear. There are times when I am not. I think I am in a state now of deep struggle.
Yeah.
And I think that's one reason why I have been open and interested in these changes that Pope Francis has brought the Church. And I think I speak for many. I mean, I'm a correspondent. I'm a newswoman who has focused my entire career on suffering, on war and disaster and the need to respond in places all over the globe, in Africa and the Middle East. I mean, if I listed for you the places I've gone, Darfur, places where no one goes to cover these stories, Congo,
in Central African Republic, we were talking about
exactly
off
this year, and you've been there, and I've been there, but also Afghanistan, Iraq, and all of that, and that's where I have focused my attention, because I think by shining that kind of light on human beings and their stories and not letting them be voiceless in these places of great pain, it is a way of pointing out that their existence matters, and that it enables, empowers the rest of us to care more, love more, judge less the rest of the world. But for me to now turn my attention to the Catholic Church, I am I'm going, I have to be very humble. I am not a reporter about religion. It's not my background.
Beat, no.
And so to be in Rome as I was recently, as you mentioned, I come with great humility because I know there's so much I don't really understand about reporting in that way. I only come as a fallen Catholic who has been schooled because of my Catholic background in the mission that I think all of us feel deeply, even when we fall from the church, mm-hmm. and that is the mission to do good for others. There is a fundamental message that we have an obligation to, I think, and this is the message, this is my interpretation, an obligation to do something to help the poor, disenfranchised.
Your vocation being a national correspondent, international correspondent, is that you think does your faith have a role in your interest in being the voice for the voiceless?
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about it. Certainly my father encouraged this kind of awareness because of his kind of thinking. I think the fact that my mother survived World War II and was herself in many ways internally displaced because of it in Japan.
And she came from, obviously, extremely vulnerable population herself.
Exactly.
Japanese population after the war.
And she was raised poor. And so all of these things, I think, have an influence. But I'll tell you an example that'll crystallize this for you. I covered the tsunami in Japan, and we were, for days, our team had to suffer because we couldn't find a place to stay that had any heat, and there was really no food. And so I had taken a team that I thought would be particularly skilled, these are people who normally work with me in these kinds of terrible places. You know, they make jokes about how I never really take them to 5-star hotels, but I make them sleep outside in sleeping bags.
And the conference in Paris would be nice once in a while.
I know, they would love that. Yeah. Which is not to say that I haven't done that, but so rarely do I get them to places where they actually have comfortable lodging. So finally, the radiation cloud, we were at Mina Minsariku, which is where the tsunami came across. I mean, it was the entire town was swept away, and we were surrounded by debris and people mourning, people they would never see again. And then we got a report from NBC. They called us up and said, get out, you've got to head to the airport. The radiation cloud is coming towards you. Run, it's on its way. And as we debated, do we run, do we fly out? I said, why don't we just drive north when we know the radiation cloud is not going to get to us so we can continue to report this story. We'll drive outside the zone. I convinced NBC, and the team agreed. So we started driving further north, and we ended up in Hokkaido. We crossed into Hokkaido where the radiation cloud was not expected to be. And finally, we had reached warm lodgings and warm, delicious food, made more delicious by the fact that we hadn't had enough for so long. And I remember Bobby, our sound man, Bobby Lapp, he said, "Ann, hey, you can have your dessert." And I said, "No, Bobby, you can have my dessert." And he said, "Okay." And then he bent his head down and started, you know, downing my dessert guiltily with this look on his face of great guilt. And I said, "Bobby, what are you, Catholic?" He said, "Well, actually, I was raised Catholic." And I said, "Really? So was I." And then I looked up and I asked the rest of my team, and you know that every single one of them except one had been raised Catholic. They had what it took to step up in a moment of great disaster, to bring voice to people who suffer, because this is what they do. These are the people who I think I have chosen as being some of the best at it. And I had no idea that they had all, except one, who actually was an add-on, who just kind of jumped into the team at the last minute, all of them had been raised Catholic. Fallen Catholics among them,
yeah.
Some who were still practicing among them. But how remarkable is that? So when you ask me, is there something about how people are raised in the Catholic faith that brings this out, I absolutely would defend that idea, mm-hmm. Because I have seen it in action.
So you can you're forever marked by that formation, I guess.
Yeah, you can leave the Catholic Church, but it does not leave you.
Yeah, you can always come back too.
And you can always come back, and that is, I think, ultimately the message of Francis and why there are Catholics who are now coming back. It is the message of mercy. Mm-hmm. God forgives you is the message. You who are human, for your sins, which you will have sins because you are human, already you are forgiven. So step forward knowing that the arms are open, the church's arms are open to you and waiting.
And the American media is often criticized for not understanding faith and not telling that story well. And most recently, the synod, we had Cardinal Dolan just a few days ago say it seemed like he was at two synods, the one he attended and the one that the press reported on. What do you think about that criticism? Do you think there's any validity to it, or do you think the press is getting sort of unfairly scapegoated for lack of general understanding about faith in America?
Well, as you know, the press is a multi-headed hydra. Is there, you know, one can go one way and another can go another. But I think that the criticism is valid, to be honest with you, because I attended the synod. I was there and was inside that room for short periods of time. And my impression is that it wasn't really a story about how Pope Francis lost or was disappointed by
the final report.
It was really that for the first time in memory, there was a degree of openness in the conversation, that there was an ability for everyone to feel, in not speaking in Latin but speaking in English, being heard, having their opinions, having everyone have a chance to speak versus sort of having the loudest ones in the room to speak. I think that there was a sense actually of a major step forward that was actually what was
collegiality,
the true,
I guess.
That
yeah.
was the true intent of Pope Francis. I don't think he ever, I mean, I can't read his mind, but my impression based on what we heard was that this is exactly what he wanted. And it was not actually a disappointment.
The media needs some drama. They need
some
headlines.
That they're trying to concoct the drama. It's so that I think we don't fully, and I think I'm in that category. As I have said, I am not a reporter of religion. And so I'm as vulnerable as any one of us to misinterpret, because we don't fully understand, those of us who have not really paid attention, as you have and as your magazine has, to the history of the church. And so I'm as vulnerable as anybody. But I would say that you can make the same comment about us in some of our reporting about global warming or about so many other topics that where we don't fully have the degree of background. And I think that's our mistake. But I think we're trying. And I will say this. I think the media has come a long way. There was a time when talking about religion was pretty rare, people's faith. Pretty rare on in the media, and now I think you hear it more and more. So I think the media also gets some credit for moving forward, and I think with Pope Francis you're going to see that accelerate.
Yeah, and with the state of the world, there's some clear religious components that are really driving current history. So I guess it behooves the mainstream media to
get with the program,
get that expertise on board.
Get with the program. We have to be smarter, no doubt about it. Yeah. And I'm trying to be.
Does Pope Francis make it more fun to cover church? Well, obviously, covering church news has been not a lot of fun in the last 5 or 10 years. So, as a one-time Catholic or somewhere in there still Catholic, is covering Pope Francis a little more fun than your other gigs out there?
I think that so much of what I have focused my work on doing has caused, actually, I will admit it to you, a kind of trauma. I mean, I've seen things that people shouldn't see, and they shouldn't see them over and over again. So I have a degree of PTSD from all of that. And I think anyone who does this kind of work does have that, and if they say they don't, they just may not want to admit it. So for me to cover a man who is a light in a place where I see so much dark, it is a joy, actually. He's so unpredictable.
Yeah.
There's an unpredictable nature. And I think that's because he doesn't follow a kind of an agenda. His motivations, from what I've been able to glean, and again, I'm not the expert here.
Yeah.
From what I've been able to glean, there is a kind of purity in his motive that allows for him to be unpredictable. And it's because most people don't understand him. I think when I spoke to Bishop Supich about him, he's never met Pope Francis, but yet I think he felt he could understand him. And I think that's what we're going to see in the Catholic Church. I think the reason why I went out and interview him and to work on a story for Nightly about him is because I thought it was really important for American Catholics to understand that a revolution is coming. A revolution, it's the Pope Francis Revolution that has already begun across the world and is reaching into America now, beginning, I think, in a significant way with the appointment of Bishop Supich. And that's not where it's going to end. It's going to continue because there'll be more appointments like Bishop Supich, people who have a new way of thinking. The thinking is this: your job as a priest, your job as a leader in your parish is not to be ambitious in the church, is to not worry about your future in the church. It is to worry about the people, to tend your parish, tend those who are disenfranchised, who are lost. I suppose I'd be among the lost.
Yeah.
Those who suffer, those who need.
And he spoke about this just the other day in Rome. He mentioned, what should bishops be doing? And he said, well, listen. You should begin by listening. And I do think this is a rather, shouldn't be so unique, but it is a unique message for the clergy and the members of the Episcopal bodies to hear that you are metaphorically the shepherd. Well, practically speaking, it's time to step up to that job as well.
It's the gospel of Jesus. You know, one of the interesting things that Supich said was, Pope John Paul, I hope I don't get this wrong,
Saint John Paul.
Right now he's a saint. Now, talked about why the church should do it. I think I have this right. And Benedict talked about how they should do it, and that the message from this Pope, Pope Francis, is do it.
Just do it. Yes.
Just
apologies
do it.
To Nike.
Apologies to Nike.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking with Ann Curry here at 30 Rockefeller Center. I'm Kevin Clark, Senior Editor, Chief Correspondent for America Magazine. Thank you for visiting with us here at americamagazine.org. Please come by again. Thank you, Anne.
Oh, but a pleasure. Thank you.